Welcome to Frenzy on the Podcast, right here on Movie City News. As always, I'm your host, Noah Forrest, and today we got Wiley Wiggins on the line. You might remember him from Dazed and Confused and Waking Life. His new movie is called Sorry Thanks, and it's playing at South by Southwest. So let's talk to Wiley. First of all, I just wanted to say I really liked Sorry Thanks. I thought it was really good. And I was actually kind of surprised how much I liked it because, you know, it kind of follows a lot of the rhythms of, like, a mumblecore movie. You know, and it's very leisurely paced. And I haven't been the biggest fan of, you know, mumblecore movies in the past. So,
Well, you're not alone.
Excuse me?
I said you're not alone.
Oh, okay. All right. But yeah, but, I mean, this was kind of, because it had a kind of improvisational feel to it. But it was also right. Kind of seemed like it was a pretty tight narrative. And I was wondering, you know, how tight you stuck to the script or if there was some improvisation involved.
There's actually only one improvisational scene with me. And from what I know, it's one of the only improvisational scenes in the movie. And it's the movie where me and Ia Hernandez's character are having their cutesy toothbrushing moment.
Mm.
So, and that was pretty much, they're just, okay, we need to establish that you guys have some kind of relationship together other than, you know.
Right.
Because the shenanigans I'm having, it's a little less, a little bit more conflicted when you see that they actually have a pretty good relationship together and they have a really good rapport.
Yeah.
So Dia actually scripted the movie very tightly. I mean, the way she directs is informed by, obviously, like, her experience producing Andrew's movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when it came down to actually shooting, when she started to get into her own rhythms of working, she realized that she was kind of a control freak. and so she came up with a really pretty innovative way of getting naturalistic performances out of first-time actors, and still managing to stick with the script. And the way that she did it was by a lot of times she would be feeding them the lines herself, as opposed to burdening them with memorizing stuff or worrying about memorizing stuff.
Right.
She'd put them in the situations and give them the lines, but made sure that they, you know, that they owned the lines, that they weren't just parroting stuff.
Mm.
And also it's what wonderfully edited.
Yeah. Well, it's really a testament to you guys as actors, you know, to be able to make it feel like this is, you know, spontaneous and real, you know. It's so I was really impressed by that, and especially since you had so many first-time actors. I mean, that's amazing.
I felt very protective of a lot of the people I was working with in there, and really I wanted them to get their best performances. And, you know, I don't know if I was really, you know, steering the scenes or anything, but I feel really good about all the performances in the movie. And I was really getting kind of irritated when, in a lot of the Q&As, not as much for us, but like for like Beeswax, or, when people talk about, oh, non-actors, oh, you're using non-actors, how do you get these non-actors to do stuff? And, you know, they're in a movie, they're acting. Means they're actors.
Right.
Obviously, pretty good actors. It's just they're not professional actors. And
they're first time actors, right. Is the more appropriate thing, I guess.
Well, and they may not do any more features for all we know, but I mean, a lot of times professional actor means model in this country.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I'm assuming you went through kind of a similar experience when you were cast in Dazed and Confused, right? Because, I mean, you were.
I mean, nobody ever talks about those people as being non-actors, and they had about the same amount of experiences.
Exactly.
Cast for either Sorry Thanks or Beeswax, so.
Yeah. All right, so I wanted to go back a little bit and ask you how you got involved with this project.
Well, I've been friends with Andrew Bujalski for a really long time. Kate Dolenmeyer, who was his lead in Funny Ha Ha, was one of the animators on Waking Life.
Mm.
And he was, they were actually roommates. They lived in Austin. and I met him through her. And then we both kind of moved to L.A. on a very ill-advised attempt to try and do more movie work and like kind of a more traditional path that I don't think went very well for either one of us. But so we were both kind of like miserable and cynical and broke at the same time in Los Angeles, and became pretty good friends. When he came down for South by Southwest with Mutual Appreciation was when I met Dia, who was the producer of that movie.
Right.
And just kind of, I'm not a jobbing actor. I do stuff with friends when people get money and want to work and, you know, have somebody with a funny name in their movie. I'm happy to help people out, but I have a day job. I'm a web designer.
Mm-hmm.
The little bit of acting that I've done otherwise has been, I did like an audiobook last year for the new Chuck Klosterman book, so I've been doing a little bit of voice work, which is fun. And I just got a random call from Dia saying, hey, do you want to be in a movie? And I knew her and trusted her and said, oh yeah, absolutely, assuming that it was a cameo part. And I got the script, and I admit I was busy at the time, and I kind of skimmed through it. But I was like, oh, this is great. This is fine. It's good dialogue. I'm happy to. And didn't really realize that it was one of the lead parts. So she called and was like, okay, so we're going to fly you out, and we're going to do rehearsals with everybody.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, really?
Yeah, kind of right. Suckered into it almost, yeah.
A little bit. I have a lot of anxiety about overexposing myself in movies nowadays. I feel like I kind of passed my freshness date about 8 years ago in terms of being like an actor. But I'm really glad I did this. I really feel like it's one of the best experiences I've had.
Well, I mean, I think you're really great in it, actually. And, you know, and I was wondering why you weren't doing more movies, but I wanted to ask you, you know, I mean, since you say, you know, like that, you know, kind of acting kind of comes and goes for you. I mean, how much did you prepare, you know, for this performance? And I mean, did you look at like other specific actors or performances, or did you just kind of draw on your own life and experiences?
I drew almost entirely off of people that I know, and I'm afraid to get more specific than that because they'll know who they are.
Mm.
I've got friends that are very much like Max, if not, you know, more functional than, or less functional than Max. Max has a pretty good job that he somehow manages to hold down.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff from myself, obviously, and just people that I know.
So do you ever, I mean, do you ever, like, you know, when you go to the movies or anything, I mean, do you ever, like, analyze, like, an actor's performance and be like, wow, like, I could do that, or, you know, like, oh, that's something I could use if, you know, I get a chance to act again, or do you kind of just not even
It depends on the kind of performance. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of, I mean, there's, you know, you could be naturalistic in something or you can be stylized. If I was doing something more stylized than this, which is, I mean, we talk about like this having the rhythms of a mumblecore movie. I think it's actually a lot more stylized than a mumblecore movie.
Well, definitely. It definitely looks like more like a real movie than a mumblecore movie.
But other than just the way that it looks, I think the sort of comic pacing that it has, mm-hmm. and the way that it's jokier than you would expect from something that's supposed to be just totally naturalistic, which was a little intimidating because Max is supposed to kind of be the most obviously like comic performance in the movie, which is can be really dangerous in a movie where you've got a lot of naturalistic performances because you stand the risk of being just the obvious, like coming off as hammy compared to everybody else. So I hope that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. So you worked.
But I'm definitely inspired and informed by all the movies that I watch. I'm a pretty voracious movie watcher.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. Actually, I'll ask you all about that. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, Richard Linklater, since, I mean, you worked in, you know, two films with him, and they're both kind of two of my favorite films, especially recent films. I mean, I watched Dazed and Confused when I was younger, and it kind of, like, amazed me, which was, and especially because it was sold as kind of like a stoner comedy, and it's really, like, anything but that. I think it's actually such a, you know, a poignant film.
Yeah, it was marketed completely against what kind of film it actually was. Surprise, surprise. But it got people into the theaters. Right? Well, actually, it didn't get people into the theaters.
Well, exactly. It became a
horrible theatrical.
And now it's a cult hit, you know? And
yeah,
I mean, do you find that people still recognize you from that film or from Waking Life?
Only on days when I've lost 30 pounds and grown a lot of hair. Around town, people know who I am.
Or someone spanking you with a paddle, and they're like, oh, hey.
Yeah, you know, if I'm at the grocery store and someone starts beating me with a with a wooden paddle, then everybody points.
I mean,
funny story about that. There was a guy in town. There was this old hermit who lived alone, had inherited a house from his parents, a gentleman in his 70s, I guess, and was like a obsessive compulsive collector, and his house was full of just stacks of like categorized newspapers and boxes of unopened, you know, whatnot. And so he died, and these junk collectors ascended on his house, and they're picking through all of his stuff. It's like open season for junk collectors. This guy's got no relatives. And one guy, this was in the local paper, one guy's going through his videotapes, and this guy's got stacks of catalog and rated porn. And he gets to one tape that's like a home, that's like a self-taped tape that's got 3 out of 4 paddles on his paddle scale, and it's just a loop of me being paddled over and over and over again and Dazed and Confused.
Wow.
I read that, and I literally did, like, a spit take of coffee almost from a newspaper.
Well, did chills go up and down your spine? I mean, like, that's...
Yeah, I don't know whether to be flattered or completely revolted or some combination of the two.
I think, both, I guess, is the... Wow. That's amazing. I never would have thought from watching that scene. You know, it's... You
know. Some old man somewhere was getting his jollies off of it.
Yeah, wow. I wonder if that's what Linklater had in mind. It's like, I hope one day someone loops this. But looking back on that experience now that it's gained, you know, a tremendous cult following, I mean, did you ever think that at the time that it would be as big as it is now? Or Waking Life, too, for that matter.
No, I mean, I definitely not Dazed. It took a long time for the movie to come out, and it was very, Criterion box that got a really great making of documentary by a woman named Kahani Korn, who was there through the whole production. And it was a pretty troubled shoot. We got a lot of pushback from the studio, and they really almost kind of buried it.
Wow.
And then only after they realized, you know, that they fucked up and there was an audience for the movie did they start pushing it hard on home video.
Yeah.
We had no idea that anybody would even see it. I mean, Rick's one movie before that was Slacker, which,
yeah,
I mean, I love. It wasn't, I mean, outside of the festival circuit, and, you know,
well,
it wasn't like...
Something not as mainstream a movie as Dazed and Confused would end up being, but... But yeah, well, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, you were working with some actors then, and you know, I bet you never figured, you know, that like Ben Affleck and Matthew McConaughey would be like the biggest stars to come.
Yeah, it's weird. The people that got famous from that movie were definitely not the people that, or at least not in the ways that you would have expected them to. Like, I never would have Matthew, like, who plays like one of the best just sleazy characters.
Yeah,
in any movie ever, that he would go on to be this kind of like hunk kind of like.
Yeah, sex. I mean, he was like the guy that was still chasing high school girls. But I think the greatest thing about that is that he named his production company after his phrase in that movie. It was like JKL Productions, right? Just keep living.
JK Living.
I think that's hilarious, but
So I really don't feel like, you know, like, it's funny, the whole mumblecore thing, I really want to. I'm really anxious for that label to go away, because I think it.
Well, I don't think that this movie is a mumblecore movie.
Yeah. But at the same time, there's other movies that by other directors that get stuck with that, and I'm anxious for it to go away, because I think, like Andrew, for instance, I think he's got probably some pretty amazing, like, genre. I think he's probably got a great old man movie in him that's just, like, all elderly people, you know, and I just think, I don't know, it's limiting, and there are some directors that I'm not as enthused about that have been grouped in with, I think, some more talented ones, and it just weighs everybody down.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and I don't really feel like what Rick did was that distant from, say, what Dia did, you know, in terms of, like, working with an ensemble cast of the directing actors that are inexperienced and getting naturalistic performances out of them, or getting naturalistic performances out of people that are maybe, like, more used to. I mean, you got to think, between Dazed and now, I've done some crappy movies too, where it was, I was expected to be more, you know, actorly or stylized or whatever. So this was like getting back to basics for me.
Right.
And she got me back to that point.
I mean, I don't think that Sorry Thanks is, you know, even. I mean, it's not really comparable to, like, a mumblecore movie like, say, you know, Alexander the Last, which is also playing at South by Southwest. You know, and because this is...
Yeah, I definitely think that they're in a different universe from one another, and I hope people realize that.
They definitely are. The commonality, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, what it also has in common with, like, you know, Richard Linklater's movies, is that they're character-based rather than plot-based. But the difference is that, you know, this movie, Sorry Thanks, actually has something to say.
Right.
Is really what it comes down
to. Well, I think it's the difference between navel-gazing and between, you know, we've got a rich history in this country of 70s studio collapse films that were character-driven.
Absolutely.
And I think it's an attempt to get back to those types of films.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, you could never have Donald Sutherland or Elliot Gould, or, you know, you couldn't have any of those great actors be stars now, because they're not models. And it's a real shame. We've lost a lot of talent has gone wasted in this country.
Right.
I mean, and there's certainly a place for beautiful people in movies, don't get me wrong, but that we there should be more criteria than just that in terms of casting and the kinds of faces and the kinds of characters we see in movies.
I'm with you.
I'd say as a dumpy person in his 30s.
Well, I mean, so what are some of the movies that you've been, like, responding to recently? Like, what are you really a big fan of that you've seen?
This is going to sound like I'm just praising my friends' films. I don't know, I'm trying to think, like, American films lately that I've been totally in love with. You might have to get back to me with an email about this.
It doesn't have to be an American film. I mean, if you feel like you've been seeing a lot of good foreign films.
I really wish Lynn Ramsey would make another movie. Do you ever see Morven Caller?
Yeah, and she did a Ratcatcher as well.
Yeah, I was more Morven Caller fan than a Ratcatcher fan. I love Samantha Morton.
Oh, she's fantastic, yeah. Well, you know, here's a better question, because this is something, you know, I ask everyone. I usually end my interviews with this, but we can talk for a little bit longer if you have the time. And that is, what are some of your favorite movies ever? I mean, if you want to open it up a little bit.
I'm a huge Alien fan. I was just thinking about this the other day. It came on, and it's that same kind of... feeling that, like, faces that you wouldn't get to see anymore in a movie. Just Harry Dean Stanton as a construction worker in space. Just never be allowed to make a genre movie like that again. That wasn't, I mean, because ostensibly it's a horror movie, but and that there's so many really vivid characters in that movie. It plays with your expectations. If you think about going back and seeing it with new eyes, I mean, just the fact that the Dallas is obviously the hero of the movie for the first chunk of the film, and you never expect, they off him immediately. He's one of the first people to go, and then you're left with with Ripley, who's this sort of protocol-driven, everybody's pissed off at her, you know, she's been a complete bitch for the first half of the movie mm-hmm. by doing her job and doing what she should have done
right.
to protect Chip.
I think Alien is probably the one Ridley Scott movie I could say that I unabashedly enjoy.
He's been so uneven other than that. I like Blade Runner a lot, but it has a lot of problems.
Well, Rutger Hauer running around in blue spandex at the end is kind of like, am I really supposed to be taking this seriously? I mean.
Yeah, they let him Hamlet it up a little bit towards the end, didn't they?
Yeah.
But.
So what else, after Alien, what else you got that's really.
I'm trying not to just fall into like, oh, well, I like Tarkovsky.
Well, you could say that. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
I love Mirror, and I love Stalker. Science fiction movie that's just a bunch of people walking through a field talking, and that somehow makes it a science fiction movie. I'm really obsessed with movies that are sci-fi based, you know, on the dialogue in them that maybe don't even have any effects or sets, like Herzog's Lessons of Darkness is one of my all-time favorites.
That's a good
films.
One. Well, yeah, also, I mean, recently Primer, I thought, was actually a great movie that was science.
I like Primer, but there's one part I think I drop off where everybody else drops off, where the plot just becomes completely indecipherable, and I just haven't. I was like, okay, should I go back and watch this again with the notebook and take notes, or. Is this a failure of the film? Because I don't think I'm that stupid. but I like it. I do like the fact that it's dialogue driven. That it's a genre movie with naturalistic performances. Like, I actually believe that those guys are engineers when they're talking. I'm like, oh wow,
absolutely,
this is actually totally believable. And one of the in Blade Runner, when I always forget the name of the actor who plays Tyrell.
Is that,
when Rutger Hauer confronts Tyrell,
is that Brian James?
Tyrell is kind of when he's kind of tossing off some biochemistry stuff. Mm-hmm. It's actually believable. I actually believe that he's a real scientist, and he's like, oh, but this is all academic, and then cuts the meat of the scene.
In Primer, it's almost kind of like, you know, the rhythm of it. You know, it's almost like Shakespearean in a way, because it's like, I'm not sure I understand every word they're saying, but like, I think I get the gist of it.
Yeah, you understand what's going on, even if it was in another language, you get the gist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Dia actually probably has a pretty good sci-fi movie in her. She reads a lot. We were talking about some stuff that we, some shorts and some books that we like together, which I won't mention because she might actually try an option one someday.
Well, I would love to see a filmmaker like her, you know, do a sci-fi movie, because I think that's when the best sci-fi movies are made, when someone who doesn't have a lot of money, you know, has to be creative. You know,
I agree.
It forces you to kind of, you know, think of a smarter way out of this that, other than like, well, we'll just CGI it later.
Yeah, I mean, you really, La Jetée, it's just a bunch of photographs,
mm-hmm.
but it takes you to a completely different place.
Absolutely.
I think young directors studying their own lives and getting almost fetishistic about little things like dialogue and characters that they know, while it may drive some people crazy, you know, that's important work to be done if you have to go someplace crazy in a movie. You know, you have to understand people, you have to understand how people talk to one another. Before you can go to Neptune.
Exactly, so you know what they will...
I think a lot of directors don't do that work. They start out with car commercials, and then they end up making, you know, car commercials in space or in other countries or,
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think to find that nice, happy medium is usually a good thing. And I think you made a good point. I mean, you wanted to make sure that when the people go to Neptune that they talk to each other the way people would talk to each other. Instead of just saying, well, we're in Neptune.
Yeah.
but yeah. All right, well, I'm going to let you go because we could do this for hours, I'm sure. But but thanks so much for coming on. And sorry, thanks. I really liked it, and I hope it does well. So.
Yeah. Me too. It's been a great experience.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Yeah. Take care.
Take care. That's all the time we have for the podcast this week. Thanks again to Wiley Wiggins. And as always, you can email me at noah@moviecitynews.com. Later.